Across the planet, the last bastions of some of Earth's most iconic animals are being threatened. With the odds stacked against them, game rangers try to protect what's left. But logging, farming, development, and poaching are all converging on some of the last strongholds of animals like tigers, orangutans, elephants, and even sharks. Today's guest is fresh off of the front lines to tell us what it's like out there and how one organization is attempting to give game rangers the tools they need to fight back. Welcome back to the Get Lost Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sills, freelance writer for outlets around the globe. Today's guest is a global conservationist. He's affiliated with projects that range from anti-poaching endeavors in Uganda to Asian elephants using prosthetic limbs in Cambodia and orangutan habitat protection in Indonesia. He's a Northern California native who slogged it out in the libraries of Cornell and Stanford before founding the Global Heritage Fund to protect UNESCO World Heritage Sites, and Global Conservation, which provides global national parks with funding to supply rangers with technologies necessary to protect biodiversity. In his travels, he's put boots on the ground in some of the world's most outstanding areas of natural beauty and biodiversity, and he's seen firsthand the impact of climate change on civilizations and wildlife. His name is Jeff Morgan, and he joins us now. Jeff, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Joe. That's good to be home in California. I had a rough trip in Asia and a couple weeks away, and it's pretty tough out there. You come home and realize how good we have it here in Northern California.
Yeah, California is an awesome place. It is my home some of the time and one of my favorite states. Talk to me about your trip. I mean, this is an exceptional opportunity for me because you're such a resource. You actually do travel the world and you have the ability to get into these like deep havens of wildlife and biodiversity. Where were you most recently?
I was in India with a new park called Muling National Park in the Northeast, near Assam. And that's an amazing basically last piece of intact forest in India that hasn't been cut before, and still intact wildlife, a lot of hunting. The Adi people there are professional hunters, very traditional for thousands of years probably, but there's deep animal. And then in Nepal, we have a project in Bardia Banke, which is really the last big chunk of area for tiger, rhino, elephant, all just impressive.
So your mission is your mission is to go to these places and figure out ways to help protect these animals. Is that correct?
Well, we're not species based. We work with national parks and indigenous territories. So in many cases, we're working with a association of indigenous groups within a territory, like the Naso people or the Ashanika in Peru, or we're working with the National Park Authority. So the director of the park and the rangers, in some cases with community protection groups. In addition, we add that in, and sometimes with the military and the police. So bringing law enforcement to a national park, in most of these countries, don't have any law enforcement, and the parks are being cut down. the land's being cleared for agriculture, and then they're killing the animals to sell or eat.
I think this could be kind of shocking news for some of our listeners in the U.S. who haven't been to global national parks. A lot of them have. But give us a picture, like paint a picture between a place like Yellowstone, where most people in America are familiar with, versus a park in Nepal or a park in Indonesia. I mean, what's the difference in the level of organization and protection around these parks?
Well, it's night and day. You know, we're talking developing countries, very few outside of, you know, Kenya, say, or, you know, some of the bigger parks in Africa that have had a lot of experience with tourism. Most of these places have very few rangers, you know, 4 to 5 rangers for 500,000 hectares, which is 1 million acres, you can imagine. Where you go to a U.S. park that's 100,000 hectares and they have 400 people working there. They have brand new suburban trucks, great weapons, you know, perfectly starched suit, nice hat, radios that work. These places don't have radio communications. If they get, you know, they get caught in a bear trap that somebody put out to catch an elephant, their leg gets cut off, they're going to die because there's just no way, there's no helicopter, there's no truck to respond. The developing world is, you know, being asked to protect 30% of their country in the 30 by 30 UN, you know, to help the climate goals. And, you know, they can't even protect the 3% that are their national parks. And they're given 5 rangers for, you know, 500,000 hectares and no radios, you know, no truck. Everywhere we go is kind of a disaster. And we need to go and, you know, go in and get the funding in and get the equipment in so that they can, you know, get somebody out of there if the ranger gets shot or the ranger loses a leg. So that the park can be protected. And that's really all we're doing. It's called Global Park Defense. And it's a 5-year program that we take each park through to get them up to speed and increase the number of rangers, increase the number of community protection, and get them all the gear and the training they need to protect the park.
Talking to Jeff Morgan, he's the founder of Global Conservation Fund. And that you use this global park defense system to set these parks up for success. You've met these rangers, and in this show, we've interviewed some people, ecologists, rangers that have been on the ground in places like Botswana and South Africa. But in your opinion, I mean, what is the mentality of these people that they live in the developing world? They probably love wildlife and nature, but they know like the role that they take on when they sign up to be a, for lack of a better term, a park ranger in a country without systems like the U.S. has. I mean, it's a dangerous job. What's their mentality like?
Really dangerous job. And I a lot of these park rangers, they don't even give them weapons to protect themselves. You know, in general, they're getting paid very little. So for them, you know, to stay in the ranger station, you know, on their phone, if they have one, and just protect what they've got in this, you know, in the ranger station is a lot. So getting them out on patrolling, you know, hundreds of miles out there as a group to protect the land and protect the wildlife there, that's our job. And so we're getting them everything that they need to do that. And it's highly appreciated. I can tell you, we need more international support for these countries. They're really, you know, living on the edge of one, you know, getting killed themselves. I don't know if you've been reading about Virunga lately. I think over 28 rangers have been killed this year, and they've had to abandon the center of the park. The entire base was taken over by rebels. You know, these are really tough places. In general, global conservation, we don't work in places like DRC. We work in Cameroon, which has better law enforcement and forest management, I would say. It's not a wild, wild west. We're working mostly just in the wild west. And you've got to give them the support and be committed over multiple years. You can't just, you know, fly in, drop off some gear and leave. and expect them to get the job done. You got to bring in trainers. You need to bring in other experts from around the region, help them build a model in one park that they can replicate in all the parks. So in Uganda, we're focused on Murchison Falls, and that has the command center. That's got the Earth Ranger software running the park. It's all real time. You can see where all the ranger patrols are, where the elephants, collared elephants and wildlife are. Radio towers so everyone can communicate throughout the park. Most of these parks are dark. They're all dark. There's no communications at all. So things like Starlink, you know, Elon Musk Starlink is going to be really important in the coming years for these places. Just getting satellite communications in so people are safe and can connect back and get support when needed.
Everyone knows what they say about fish stories, but this one is true. A while back, I was mountain biking along the Arkansas River near a place called the Big Dam Bridge. In the distance, I could see the afternoon sun falling over Little Rock's lone round peak. Beside me, I saw a tranquil, rippling pool next to an old railroad bridge, secluded from the rapid river's flow. It was exactly the kind of spot that I'd biked there for. So I hopped off the bike, reached into a backpack, and pulled out a fishing rod. Then I spent the rest of the afternoon watching time slowly roll by in the warm afternoon sun. I even caught a few fish right there in that spot, with my bike laying on the ground and the shallow sand beneath my feet. This is the kind of fishing story that doesn't have a big catch or a record bass attached to it. It's just a peaceful afternoon by the water, the kind that helps you unwind from all of the problems in life. If you listen to this podcast, chances are you've got a nose for adventure yourself. And if that nose leads you to the water, I suggest picking up a tool that can help you enjoy more moments like these. When I travel, I often pack a fishing rod. And though many portable options abound, I like the rods from Wisconsin's St. Croix rods the best. St. Croix's Avid Trek and Triumph travel rods break down into a case that fits in a backpack, or an overhead bend, or behind just about any car seat. They're designed in the USA and made with care from a family-run company that knows some fishing stories don't require any exaggeration. Sometimes, just being on the water is enough. You can learn more about St. Croix's travel rods at stcroixrods.com, and you can tell them the Get Lost podcast sent you. Now, back to the show. This is probably a really complex question, but I want to ask on a fundamental level, what's the solution here? I mean, the parks that I've worked in with rhino conservation and things like that, pangolin protection and things like that, it's poaching. So the limited number of places I've been, there's poaching going on, whether that's tapir in Brazil or whether it's rhinos in Africa. People know about those kind of things. Is poaching a blanket problem across the globe? Or are there other issues that go into conserving this land that we really need to combat climate change and rising global temperatures?
Well, clearly communities that live in the forest are the, you know, like we work with the Naso people. There's 60 Naso now patrolling under global park defense for about 400,000 hectares. And they are, you know, they're operating. The national park next door, same size, only has three rangers. So, you know, in some cases, the communities are going to be a lot stronger. You want to enable them to protect the lands. But poaching isn't the only problem. You have they're cutting the forest. They're illegally logging the best trees out of the forest. When they go in to cut these trees out, they also bring their guns in and they shoot all the animals. So, you know, that's a big thing. And then just actually stealing land, you know, where they're squatting inside the park, that no one's there. So they just go in and cut down 50 hectares, plant their crops, or steal the wood and burn down the forest. And you know, that's kind of the status quo in a lot of these countries. There's just nobody there to protect the park. And that's what we've got to change. We need, you know, the big issue is a lot of the big NGOs I won't name any names, but the money doesn't get to the park itself, get to the field. So we got to get the funding direct down to the park. You don't give the money to the government. You give the money for equipment, training, and the actual operations of the patrolling and make sure it gets there. And we need a lot more of it. We need, you know, really a lot. I would say most of these countries need 5 to 10 times larger budgets to protect what they've got.
Loaded question. Where does that money come from?
A big chunks of money are coming from multilaterals, the United States government, European government, UK, under government programs. The problem with that model is the money goes from the UK to the government of Cameroon. And so then it just disappears. It's I hate to say it, but yeah, so that's not a good strategy. The money needs to go directly to, you know, results-based programs for protection of these parks. And that's called, we just call that global park defense, and getting the money right to where it needed in an organized way so that it's park protection focused. It doesn't go and get siphoned off into a bunch of different you know, programs like setting up barbershops so people have better income. You know, there's a lot of livelihood programs where I see money just disappearing. I see, you know, it sounds good. You want to improve the livelihoods and the economics for a lot of these people. Tourism is obviously a very good way to do that because it keeps going. It's sustainable. And tourism actually gets down to the level of each person. It's not a run by some big conglomerate. You know, anyone can set up a homestay. Anyone can set up a small lodge, buy a taxi and be a taxi driver, or have a truck and do wildlife touring, be a guide. So the tourism thing is actually a real winner when it's not, you know, over the top and too many.
I think it's important to note here that Jeff's a guy that has decades of experience in global conservation, not just with animals and biodiversity, but archaeological sites and things like that. Did you experience the similar issues when you were working to protect archaeological sites with Global Heritage Fund?
Well, it's a very different issue because the national parks are 1 million hectares. Usually archaeological sites is just 1 or 2 square miles.
Sure, yeah.
Archaeological sites actually have a better direct economic impact. As soon as you're UNESCO World Heritage, like Angkor Wat, we're working in Bante Chamar, which is about 5 hours north of Angkor. People start coming there and everybody can make money. You know, there's, right. You know, you can be a guide, set up a hotel. So it's fairly concentrated. Now, you know, when you say protect the Amazon, to me, that just seems almost impossible. I mean, I could, if there's a national park that has an amazing waterfall that everyone wants to go to in the Amazon, and we can concentrate on that 200 or 400,000 hectares, that makes sense to me. Or a strong indigenous group like the Jingu or the Yanomami, giving them the capacity to protect their own territory, that makes sense. But just to say we're going to protect the whole Amazon, wow, I mean, that's, it's really hard.
I mean, it's a gigantic area. Done some work.
And there's no tourism potential. You know, the Amazon, once you've gone into the Amazon, you've kind of seen it. You know, it's not like people are going to keep coming back. They want to go to specific famous places in the Amazon. And if you want to build tourism, that's why we think UNESCO World Heritage and national parks are so important, because they're established for a reason. There's something special there that people are going to come to see, whether it's the waterfalls or the wildlife or this, you know, type of forest. And so, you know, let's take care of the best, you know, the best places, the last great places, make sure they're protected before we try to go and do 30 by 30. Let's protect 30% of the country. I mean, I just don't even see how that's possible. We can't even protect the 3% that we've already established as World Heritage and National Park.
I think you bring up a really good point with the UNESCO sites. They almost seem to have a Bourdain effect or an Instagram effect, and you just flock to it like Angkor It's pretty tough to get some private time at Angkor. You have to walk around the back way. I could tell you how to do it, but it's a little bit tricky. Now, I want to switch gears here and sort of get into the mission of the show today, which is to talk about July 29th, World Tiger Day. And you were just up in Nepal doing some work in an area where tigers are prevalent, in India, where tigers are prevalent. You've worked in Sumatra, where tigers are prevalent, and Thailand. So you have a pretty good grip
on the looser ecosystem, last tigers of Sumatra.
Yeah, right. So let's talk about Sumatra. Let's talk about the looser ecosystem and help people understand what the scene is there. I mean, what is it like to actually go there? Most people have never even heard of this place. So first, we got to pinpoint it on the map.
Well, I think one thing you should talk about, if you're going to talk about tigers, is that tigers are the apex species, right?
Right.
So they require a lot of territory. If you've got good tiger population, that's a great sign that you're taking care of the area.
Would they be considered an umbrella species in a way that...
Completely.
Yeah. So if you protect the tigers, then you're protecting everything underneath them as well, right?
That's a great indication you're doing a good job on all their prey, right? The deer that they eat, all the other animals that they're, you know, eat. And so, tigers, elephant, rhino, orangutans, if those guys are doing okay in a park like looser ecosystem, then you know all the other animals are doing pretty well. So for me, that's an important indicator. In general, tigers now have lost 92% of their territory, where their historic territory. So they're down to now about 8% of their territory. And, Thailand, where we are working, we've Top Lawn National Park and the Western Forest Complex together, those places have about 120 tigers left. That's it. So you start getting under 100 of any species, like a tiger or, you know, an elephant, you're really going to have problems breeding, keeping the getting it back. So when, you know, these places that say, oh, we have a sanctuary that has the last 10, the last 10 Javan rhino, you know, it's over. I mean, it's just done. Oh, we're going to use DNA and try to clone them. You know, you've screwed up. You got to protect everything now while we still have 100+. And that's what Thailand's working hard on. You know, Nepal's done a better job than anyone. India as well. They're increasing tiger numbers with 1.5 billion people. So you can imagine the human wildlife conflict potential there, where tiger numbers are doubling and the people are doubling, right?
Yeah.
And they've just done such a great job. I'm so impressive, the amount of effort, the number of rangers they have just following the tigers around to warn villages ahead of time that there's tigers in the area. You know, they're collaring them so they can keep track of them. They're using radio to follow them around and just warn everybody, hey, there's a tiger in the area. Don't go out tonight. You know,
that's a great approach. That
produces a lot.
That's an incredible approach. And I didn't even think about that, but you bring up so many issues here. Yeah. 1.5 billion people, if they can do it, would that suggest to you that any country could do it? May not have the resources of an India, but it's happening, right? It's doable.
Yep. Yeah. And they don't have, you know, the Hmong people of Vietnam are famous hunters, and they go to all the other countries in Asia and kill the tigers. That's what they do. And so they're going to Malaysia, and, you know, it's amazing. They're catching these people from Vietnam in all these other countries because they're going there to hunt tigers specifically, and then, sell the pelt, the teeth, the bone. And they seem to think it's okay to do. I don't quite understand, because we're down to the last 100 in Malaysia, the last 100 in Thailand, and they're still going out there and hunting them down to kill them.
Do you know what the market rate for tiger is, like these tiger parts? What percentage of like an annual income would that represent?
Oh, no, it's huge for them. I mean, it's thousands of dollars for the hunter. He might make $5,000. And then in China, the whole skin, bones, everything, you might get, you know, $40,000-$50,000.
This is interesting to me, because I would assume that poaching comes from communities where there's not any other option to make income. But I've been to a lot of Hmong villages in Vietnam, and they have a booming ecotourism industry.
Backpackers. But somehow there's just these hunters that are so good at what they do. They go out, you know, and go all over Asia to kill the last tigers that they can get their hands on. And it's just scary. You know, you got that. You've got the loss of habitat, right? Just the shrinking of the place. A tiger needs a lot of space. Right. Yeah. They're traveling around looking for a mate, marking their territory with their urine and their musk. And so other tigers don't come in here. And then they find a female to mate with, and they need a lot of territory. They need to eat well. And if they get caught in a snare trap and lose part of their leg, their life is over. They're no longer able to hunt. They're not ever going to be able to catch a fast gazelle or a fast animal in the forest. And their snares. Snares are the worst. We pulled out over 100,000 snares out of the Cambodian cardamom's forest last year in 1 year. 100,000 snares. If you look at the Guardian article that just came out in Uganda, our work in Uganda, in 6 months, the pile of snares is two stories tall.
Oh, my God.
That's from 6 months. And those are bear trap, wire snares. They're putting them out all over the forest. And even the rangers are stepping in them and losing their legs. So it's just indiscriminate murder and mayhem out there. And these are really good parks. So we're talking about Murchison Falls, the oldest jewel of Africa, Ugandan Wildlife Authority, and you know, one of the top wildlife authorities in Africa. And they're just the pressure of so many people coming in from around the park. There's no animals anymore outside the park, not even a squirrel. Okay, everything's gone. So they have to come into the park to do the trapping. They set out these miles of wire snares, big bear traps all over the place to catch a hippo or an elephant or a water buffalo. And they're just doing complete destruction. And it's just terrible what's going on.
It's difficult for me to wrap my mind around that level of situation. I do recall the first trip I had to Africa where I go over and we usually have this Lion King vision of Africa in our minds where you go into the continent's wild and there's wild animals everywhere. And it wasn't like that. It was like, yes, those places exist, but they exist in fenced private reserves because that's what's protected.
South Africa, mostly private reserves. Yeah.
Yeah. That was it for me. And like, I did see all that stuff. I'm not going to discount where I was and the work going on there at wildlife reserves, but it wasn't quite like what you have in your mind as a teenager or a little kid growing up in America, where we just don't have that level of comprehension. Like, it's not the Wild West here anymore. And you grew up in
California. We do a great job taking care of our parks in the United States. And my feeling is we should be a model for the world. Mm-hmm. And we should be putting out billions of dollars to help poor countries protect their national parks. It's a great way to help other countries through foreign aid is use our model. We do foreign aid. We do $45 billion a year in foreign aid through USAID, and none of it protects national parks, which is our most valuable model.
Yeah.
You know, freedom, liberty, justice, those are American values, democracy, but also national parks.
Yeah.
And we should be all those, you know, great, you know, alumni and rangers and superintendents that work in the U.S. should be in Colombia helping them do it, should be in Brazil helping them do it, should be in South Africa helping these other countries that really don't have their parks protected.
When the parks here are
I think it's great, you know, the U.S. has got a great model, but we don't have zero money to export it to really help these poor countries take care of what they got.
Yeah. And the parks here are such a success that now at a lot of the popular ones, you have to book in advance. You can't just go into Arches or Zion anymore. I think even Yosemite might have, like, you have to book your time, right?
Any peak season, there's millions of people, and it's almost, you know, becoming not, you know, very interesting to go, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's easy for us to sit here also in a dangerous trap to fall into as Americans. You know, we're kind of born into being whether we're on the poor end of America or the high end, we're still part of like globally wealthy country, right? Poverty here in a place where I grew up, like Memphis, is not the same poverty that is in Africa. It's just not. I've seen it. It's just not the same thing. And both are bad. Don't get me wrong, but like it's a different level entirely. Talk to me
and
about
they need to eat, and the parks have the animals to eat or kill to sell and make some money for their families. So it's really unless you do bring the tourism to take over that, right?
Yeah,
it's really that's why it's important that we pick the parks that we pick to work. Have a high potential long-term for tourism, because if you can't convert someone from exploiting the wildlife to conserving the wildlife and protecting them, so they make, you know, they can be a guide and make a lot more money because there's a lot of animals to see, right? There's more people right. coming. And if you don't do that, and Kenya knows how to do it, they've invested heavily. I think now 12 to 15% of the Kenyan GDP is tourism. Wildlife tourism. So they hire 20,000 environmental police, and the Kenyan Wildlife Service is huge. I mean, they're just dedicated to protecting that economic engine. And that's a little bit, that's really what we need to do in each country. Make the park a model, get the people to be able to come there safely, and engage the communities so that they can benefit from the park. That'll turn things the best. That's the best thing to turn the situation around.
So a couple questions here. When you talk to other countries about that model or people in different parks in other countries, are they receptive to it? Can you say, look at Kenya, look at Kenya. These are the numbers.
Everybody does. Yeah. Everyone in Africa, every country, every president looks to Kenya as a model for wildlife and saving the elephants and everything else. You know, in most of these countries where I work, the people in the jobs of the park directors or the Ministry of Environment, they're pretty knowledgeable and pretty proud of what, you know, their country has. But the level of resources available to them to execute protection, to, you know, build a ranger station, to pay for new tires for a truck, pay for fuel to be able to patrol, just get some food so they can actually go for 4 days. It's not there. You know, either the bureaucracy and the procurement through the government's slow. They just can't get together. That's why global conservation and groups like us are so important, because we get that funding right there where they need it, when they need it. Then they can, you know, do the bigger budget items. I need a new boat. I need a new truck. Those might take 3 years through the government, but we can get the patrols operating right now with the radios, with the mapping, with the planning, you know, and really get those arrests. The big thing you have to do is you have to arrest. And get people scared to go in the park. I'm not going there anymore. You know, Bob got arrested. Johannes was arrested. They're still in jail. I'm not going to do that. I don't want, I'm going to do something else.
Like an actual deterrent.
Yeah. If you don't, you know, and that's the same with any crime. And the interesting thing, I was in Bardia in Nepal last week, and they're very successful. They had 50 arrests last year. But you know what that means? That means there are probably over 500 poachers still working in the park, because they don't arrest everybody. How many times have you done something wrong, right? You don't get arrested every time you speed,
which is
drive like fast. Daily. That's right. So these people are out hunting without repercussion. They're not being arrested, and we're lucky when we do arrest them. So that you got to realize that the pressure is so high, even in Nepal, where they're doing the best job protecting tigers and rhino than anyone else. They're putting their military in every park to do that, budgeting a lot of money from a very poor government to protect their wildlife. It's so impressive, but still, you know, there's too many people coming in trying to kill animals.
Let's talk about the tourism aspect of this, because I know that you worked heavily in tourism before, and you're right, it drives economies and it can be a part of a solution here. What would a tourist see if they decided to go to Bardia, if they decided to go where you go on the ground? Is it safe for them? Are they able to go on tours?
Everywhere is so different. Bardia in Nepal is so special because you can do walking tours. You can ride in on an elephant and do the tours on an elephant, which is kind of cool. I mean, a lot of people are against that, or by truck. And so you're in 3 days, you see everything. You see tigers, you see elephant, you see a rhino, you see tons of other animals out there. Crocodiles, these amazing crocodiles, these thin beaks. Just incredible place to I think explore. And no, we were there last week. We didn't see any foreign tourists, nobody. And we're walking through the forest and there's tiger right across the river. I mean, this place is because they protect it. You know, outside the national park, there are no animals.
Can you put me in the mindset of that moment when you're walking through this park and you're in Nepal and you see a wild tiger? I mean, what goes through your mind? What do you
sensing? Well, tigers are kind of a little bit scared of humans in a group of people. They'll hear or smell you and go away. But if you just bounce up on an elephant and suddenly you're 10 feet from the elephant and he's got his baby there, she's got her baby there, you're in deep trouble and you're running, you know. So they're putting you through safety training, where to run, behind a big tree, dead tree, under a tree, whatever you can do. Mm-hmm. And you hope that they don't, you know, target you and just go after you until they kill you, because that they do that. You know, and the rangers, unlike Botswana where you were, the rangers have a stick. They don't have a gun.
That's not ideal in my view. I do recall outside of Kruger, we work with an anti-poaching group, and it was sort of an educational thing. They take eco-volunteers and stuff, but you do go on the ground and you track these rhinos deep into the bush because you have to ID them and log where they're at and stuff like that. And that was pretty sketchy. I mean, you're on the ground with apex predators like lions and more scary elephants. Because you could just bumble into them and they might not like you.
They're hiding in the bush and you don't even see them until it's too late.
Unreal how an animal as big as an elephant can hide, but I promise you they really are good at it. But at least the ranger that we were with there did have a rifle. So, you know, there's some measure of like if things get really out of hand, you've got a chance.
Or you just piss off the elephant even more because, you know, you just pissed him off.
There's also that. But you're saying in Nepal, they just have a stick and they're like, hey,
wave. Guides have a big stick and that's it. We're walking around with sticks. You know, they haven't had any big problems. You know, animals aren't interested in, you know, hunting down and killing people. They're, you know, they kind of go the other way and they're. It's more the surprise or that when you have an infant in the mix, right? That causes the problem. But, you know, it's just so special. I just tell you, well, Nepal, between the people, the cultures they have, the food, and being out there where there's just no visitor. You know, all the people go to Annapurna Trail. The people are going to Chitwan, which is the main park near, more closer to Kathmandu, or they're going to Everest, you know. You go to Bardia Banke and you're out there in a park that is just, you know, pristine. It's like it was 500 years ago. Wow. And that's kind of what we're looking for in marine. You know, we work in both the land and marine. And we were in Cuba last year, for example. And that was the last place in the Caribbean where you can dive and see sharks, you know, and grouper. The Caribbean is gone. The entire Caribbean. Okay, you can dive and see a little fish about 4 to 5 inches long, or, you know, maybe some bigger ones if you're lucky. And Cuba, because of poverty, and they don't have fishing, tons of fishing, like in Miami, where you have thousands of boats with, you know, people fishing.
Yeah.
This place called Jardín de la Reina is intact. And that, to me, is the model, what we have to spend our money on. Focus on the last intact, you know, bastions of biodiversity. Then once those are protected, those can grow out, right? The ocean takes the fish to different places. They have a safe place to grow in Bardia. We're taking care of those animals. So then once there's enough rhino, we can take a few of those and move them over to the next park, you know, but if we let those last bastions go, and that's what all global conservation is focused on, the last bastions where there's intact forest and intact biodiversity. And they are fewer and far in between. So they're becoming so scarce now. It's just, for me, it's incredible. You go to Indonesia and it's hundreds of miles of palm oil plantations just for miles and miles. And you're flying over for an hour and you don't see any forest left anymore. So, you know, that all happened in the last 20 years. Sumatra went from all forest to looser ecosystem, and a couple other small parts are the last forest left in 20 years. So the whole planet's going like that. That's what you got. The message I would give is the scarcity now of in last intact places is just, you know, those places, we got to protect them now. We need to get sufficient funding directly targeted at those places and help them right now.
So we're at a point now where you're saying we have to circle the wagons. Like, we're losing them. This is it. Like, extinction isn't about Tasmanian tigers anymore. It's not the dodo bird. It's like species that you grew up with that are charismatic animals, like orangutans and tigers and rhinos. Like, this is all going on right now. We're going to lose all this. Circle the wagons. How does the average person help? What can they do?
Well, I think if everybody in the United States and Europe, for instance, had an extra $100, they gave to one of the conservation groups in their favorite country, their favorite park that's doing protection, that would make a big difference. You know, because a lot of times these small NGOs that are working in Zambia in that park, you know, if they're honest and you know, not there's no corruption there, you got to make, you know, do your due diligence, but. You know, start out with $100, and then as you build the trust, you can give them $1,000. You can give them $10,000, but start out with $100, right? And get them the resources they need so that the patrols can happen. It's really down to patrolling. Presence is everything. If the people know they're going to get arrested, they stop coming. They go somewhere else, or they have to give up what they're doing and get a job at a hotel, you know. Or start a business or whatever they're going to do. And if there's nobody there, which is the case of most of the parks, you know, everything's going to get wiped out.
You know, it's an interesting thing because it's almost like if the poachers keep doing what they're doing, they're going to run out of a job anyway, right?
That's right.
Like, it just is what it is. Like, you run out of trees to log, you run out of fish to catch. It's just a finite resource.
It's happening all over the world. Come on, you hear about it every day. A new big fishery in Philippines is just gone. You know, the east coast of the United States, the fishery collapsed, right? Because they just overfish it. All of Florida now, the Key West of Florida, where everyone used to go grouper fishing, all that, though, they can't catch anything anymore because they killed everything. You know, and it's just like, to me, it's just, you know, one, you got to do the protection of these critical places, the national parks, and outside of there, then you need to do management of the game management. And you see that in the U.S., we do a good job. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state, you know, wildlife services do the best job they can to have seasonal hunting. You have to get a tag. You can't kill, you know, 50 animals. You get two. Yeah. That's all you get. And that's how you sustain things. And that's how indigenous people have done it in the past. They'll log certain trees and leave the forest standing, or they'll hunt certain fish, or they'll fish certain areas only 2 months of the year and then give it 10 months to recuperate. You know, but what's happening in this world, they were just fishing, hunting, killing, cutting, burning all year long with the trucks that we're using, the tractors that we're using for mining, for clear cutting the forest are huge now. And they can just take out the whole island of Sumatra in 20 years.
I have a question for you. As someone who's seen a lot of the world in really remote places, you've also seen a lot of horrible things, and probably some amazing things. Do you think you have a fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic view of humanity?
Oh, I would. I'm an optimist always. There's so many great people out. If you just work with the people that we work with, they're just heroic, you know, and doing the stuff they're doing out there. I get to come back to you know, San Francisco and, you know, drive my car, nice roads. The air is clean. Everything, you know, there's, you know, except for the San Francisco, the crime's pretty bad, not so bad. just, you know, we live in a we live in paradise. All right. And these guys are out there, at men and women, dedicating their lives to save, you know, the zebra of Zambia or the, you know, national park of Zimbabwe every day. It's tough, really hard. You know, not only is it hot, sometimes heavily polluted, or, you know, it's dangerous. People are shooting at you. You know, these are bad people that you're trying to stop. So they're just, it's really heroic. And that gives me so much inspiration. I mean, just my job is just to help all these heroes out there save their parks. And that, you know, that's just endless optimism for me. I just, you know, they keep coming back with more success. I keep giving them more help. And that's what we can do.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think my worldview is fundamentally optimistic. And I think humanity, like humans are in general, in their natural state, I think they're good, but the bad ones are pretty scary. I want to rewind a little bit as we sort of wind the show down, but I meant to ask you this at the jump of things, because we go through your list of accolades in your bio, and it's Cornell and it's Stanford, and you founded a lot of businesses and nonprofits that help the world. But you also worked in Silicon Valley, and you're from there. You worked at Hewlett Packard. You worked at Sun Microsystems. You founded your own tech company. How does that shape the opportunities that you're able to create for other people in the world?
Well, I can tell you right now that people are not taking advantage of the cloud computing and the internet in a lot of these countries, right, to protect their parks, right? We have free Global Forest Watch. We'll give you real-time fire alerts for your park. Just one example, it's free. Planet Labs now takes a picture of the Earth every day. That's free. So we just have to get those tools to these parks. You know, they have satellite, all the parks, they don't have communication. Well, there's a $500 Garmin satellite device that lets you text message, hey, I just got my leg cut off in a trap, save me, you know. We're getting shot at, please help us. And they haven't had that. They don't take advantage of basically very low cost technologies, whether that's a marine radar that's watching for illegal fishing, or these trail cameras, which send a video of the guy coming through the trail on it with a gun or a dead animal on its back, that allow the rangers to be more effective. So it's combining the direct funding with the Silicon Valley technology that I think is going to let us win this war.
Yeah. You even out the odds, or in some cases tip them in the favor.
And it's consumer technology. You know, it's not military technology that costs millions of dollars. It's a $500 camera, a $300 satellite communicator, a free cloud computing, watching the forest 24/7. So when there's a fire, you can get there before it burns down 100, you know, acres, right? You only lose 2 acres. Yeah. So important. And they're not taking advantage around the world. You'd be surprised. You know, we had a conference, 120 top park leaders came to call last year. I said, how many of you guys are using Global Forest Watch? And like 3 people were using it. And those are the directors of the parks. Why wouldn't you use it? It's free every day. You know, it's millions of dollars to help you protect your park that's been invested. And those are the types of things. You know, and this using satellites for monitoring forests is critically important, especially when you're talking about trying to get red credits, red plus carbon credits, right? Yeah. Carbon offset credits. If you don't use satellites, what are you going to send people around with tape measures and measure the trees?
So can you break that down real quick? Because I think most people haven't heard of that. It's you get credits for carbon offsetting, but you have to prove that there's...
That you're saving the forest.
Okay. So you have to prove there's reforestation.
Think of a tree. Tree is breathing, giving oxygen to the planet, right? You cut that tree down, you lose that power. Right. And so about 30% of the climate change solution can be done just leaving our forests standing. Don't cut them down and plant soybean. Don't run cattle. You know, just leave the forest standing, because they're these big old trees. They produce a lot of oxygen.
Yeah. So just do nothing, essentially.
Well, not do nothing. You got to protect them. Otherwise, they'll cut them down and sell them.
Okay.
And then they'll bring the cattle in, and the cattle are death to you know, tons of just massive. In Colombia alone, the last 10 years, they lost 5 million acres of forest to cattle. So and what that does, it's two things. It's terrible because one, they're taking cocaine, they're making money on cocaine, right? Selling it to the United States. So they're getting rich, millions of dollars. How do you get rid of the money? We got to launder it. So we buy cattle. So then go out to these lands, they cut down all the trees. They can sell the trees right there. So they make money again on the trees, buy thousands of cattle and run them on the land. Then they can squat on the land. They say, well, I've been here farming cattle for 20 years. You have to give me the land.
Mm-hmm.
Take it from the national park or take it from the government. No, now it's my land. So it's a terrible situation. Most of these countries, they're too weak to protect the government lands and the national parks. And they're getting just invaded by cattle people illegally putting thousands of cattle out into the park.
Is there a future where countries that do have the ability to protect and conserve their lands can pick up the slack? Is that an option? If we can't keep the forest in Colombia from disappearing, can we pick up the slack elsewhere?
No.
That's it.
We have to protect. No. If you want to keep the earth at, you know, this 1.5 degree goal or 2.0, whatever they decide, 30% of that. So you more than cars. If everyone stops driving a car today, you're not going to solve the problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
30% is just protecting those forests, the Amazon, the Congo, and all these other forests in each country.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And they're standing forests. They're old growth forests. So everyone's talking about reforestation. I didn't realize how weak that is because you're planting a new tree. It doesn't generate oxygen like an old, you know, a big old tree is going to generate 2,000 times more oxygen than this little tree that grows. In the first 20 years, it doesn't generate anything. So you can plant a trillion trees. You're never going to be able to protect the planet like protecting the old forest.
Talking to Jeff Morgan, he's the founder of Global Conservation. Jeff, as we wind down here, let's talk about this video you guys just put out, Saving the Last Tigers. We're coming up on World Tiger Day. It's July 29th. By the time this episode drops, we'll be right on the dot. Talk to us about the video and how you guys made it, why you decided to make it, and what it highlights.
Well, we do video a lot in our work because that helps people in the U.S. and Europe that are our donors and funders, you know, see the work we're doing in real. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to write about it in text. A podcast is new to me too. I think it's great. But video shows the, you know, here's the work that we're doing. Here's the people we're arresting. Here's the rangers we're equipping and training. And so this video was done by Paul Hilton. He's a very famous videographer and photographer. He just got back from they're trying to create Greater Koala National Park, and he's shooting the koalas up in the trees as they're logging, and the koalas are coming down with the trees. You know, he does underwater and above ground, so he's just an amazing videographer. You can see all almost all the video he shot of that, and it's a story about, really, it started out as rosewood poachers coming into the national park to cut rosewood. So they've cut down all the mahogany. They are the 20 years ago, 10 years ago, they all the teak's gone. And now they're going back for rosewood to build basically red furniture to sell in China. It brings good luck and whatever. So
naturally
they're going into the park, cutting the rosewood. Well, when they're in there, they're staying for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, mm-hmm. Cutting these trees up. And they go in there with guns and they're killing all the animals too, because they eat the animals. And so what happens is the prey for the tigers is decimated because there was over 1,000 people when we started going in there. And we got our arrests up. I think it was up over 1,000 over 4 years. And they just finally stopped. And that gave the tigers a chance. The prey started coming back. And then now we found 2 or 3 families of tigers in that park. And there's no one coming back to do the rosewood illegal logging anymore. And you have to do that. You have to take the pressure off so the animals can survive. You know, they need prey. If you kill all their prey, they're going to die. If you shoot them, they're going to, you know, that doesn't help either. Right.
You and, feel like those tigers now have a chance, like that small population, because you were able to help stop the logging.
Oh, yeah, they're going to grow and they're going to expand. There's two other parks on both sides, and these tigers will be able to go into those parks and hopefully be protected and going forward. So yeah, Thailand's, you know, in the front line, you know, there's so many, they just put a CEO of a major a transportation construction company. He was out hunting with his family and he had a Black Panther in his soup pot when the Rangers came to his camp. And what? His wife was carving up another one. So they had killed two Black Panthers and he was eating one. She was cooking one and cutting up the other. And so he was like a 55-year-old CEO of a Thai company. He's in jail now. And that ranger was threatened with his life. I mean, he was so brave. It's amazing he wasn't killed and his family killed by this guy. But they got him to jail. He was moved to a different place and protected. And now this guy's in jail. And it's the first time in Thailand there's real hope that they're going to enforce their wildlife laws with these type of people.
You feel that message resonated?
Thailand couldn't believe it. People in Thailand couldn't believe this guy's in jail.
Okay. So, and that,
just
and
couldn't
that.
Believe there's, yeah. What's nice is a lot of countries are progressing and coming forward. Some are back 20 years behind the US, some are back 30 years, but some are 10 years behind. You know, Thailand's kind of like 5 to 10 years behind where they need to be. And they're coming up fast. They're a strong country. I have huge respect for the government and the Department of Parks there, doing great work. We, for a good example, we started with these trail cameras. We're taking videos all around the park of people coming in. That's how the rangers can get them.
Yeah.
Right? And so we use the ranger. It's gone out by cell phone. They like that program so much, they bought 3,000 cameras and they put them in all their national parks. So that's how you can get your global defense model replicate to everywhere else. That's what we're trying to do, is get everyone to protect what they got.
Bringing it back home as we wind down to the U.S. side of things. I know there's listeners all over UK, South Africa, France, Australia. I see you guys. Most of us are still in the States for this show. Bringing it back to the American level, are there places in the U.S. that need protection like this?
Well, the United States has law enforcement, so that works. We have courts, judges that actually work. A lot of these countries, that's where the breakdown. We arrest people, we take them to court, and the judge doesn't really care about wildlife crime. You know, he cares about murders or robberies, you know, carjacking. Yeah. So the wildlife crime gets a short shift. That's a big problem. So we have to do a lot of training of prosecutors. We have to pay for the prosecutors to get to the court. A lot of times they don't own a car, you know, so we got to pay their bus or rent a car. And just training the prosecutors and the judges on wildlife crime, like Kenya has done a good job, right? Kenya has done that training, so people are arrested and prosecuted successfully. Other countries are, you know, 10, 20 years behind.
I got you.
It's the whole, you know, the nice thing is U.S. has law enforcement. I was up at Crater Lake the other day with a park director, and he said they just caught two guys that were out hunting there.
That's in Crater Lake,
you know, in Crater Lake, Oregon.
A hugely popular U.S. national park.
Yeah, but they're in the backwoods out hunting. Just look up wildlife poaching USA. You'll see some pretty bad stories. You know, people caught with a lot of carcasses, a lot of birds, a lot of wild cats that are being either stuffed and traded. It's you know, eagles. People are still out there killing, and they have the difference is they have very sophisticated weapons in the United States. You can shoot stuff from a long way. They got night scopes, you know, night vision, thermal. So they've got camera traps that are, you know, watching for them, and then they can see if the animal's there, then they go. So they're quite sophisticated. Things outside the national parks are still being hunted pretty heavily. Fortunately, the national parks, you know, I would say, except for the marijuana growing, you know, the Mexican cartels have come up into a lot of the parks in Arizona, California, New Mexico, and they're growing tons of marijuana. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty dangerous. I'm sure they're killing stuff too to eat. But it's, you know, you don't see, what you do see in the U.S. is you see a line of trucks, you know, 200 trucks waiting outside of Yellowstone National Park for hunting season to open. Right. And waiting for those bears to come out of the park, the moose to come out of the park. And right. then it's blam, 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 blam. And everybody's sitting there drinking beer. They got their big old truck. They got their big guns. Yeah.
We're not pointing any fingers at you, Montana, but hey.
No, we love Montana. But, you know, and hunting should be, you know, game management is important and hunting is important. I'm not against hunting. Unregulated, illegal hunting, for sure.
Yeah. Last question I have for you, because you're such a resource and expert, and I know we've taken a lot of your time today, so thank you for that. Sure. What is the future of wildlife on Earth? Prediction.
I think if we, you know, I'm working with a lot of great people around the world, like the Moore Foundation and others that are dedicating a lot of money and their efforts to protect big chunks of forest and wildlife in those forests. I think if we can just save 3%, you know, I'm a 3%. If we can just get these really important, you know, intact bastions where there is wildlife and really protect them, I wouldn't say put a fence around them or put a fortress around them, but work with the communities around the area to really protect them. You know, we can save enough to move forward. You know, you can't save everything.
Yeah, I think, but now it's time to circle the wagons, as you alluded to. Jeff, right. thank
Double
you so much.
Double down on the places that are already designated national parks. Why are there only 5 rangers and no budget for 1 million acres, right? You created a national park. A lot of these people have been creating national parks, and then there's no money for them to protect themselves. Yeah. And that is wrong. Don't create something and not protect it. That's why the 30 by 30 to me, it sounds a little bit, you know, we can't protect the 3%. Why are you saying protect 30? You, we're going to protect 30%. And all these countries are signing up for that, thinking they're going to get a lot of money to do it. The money doesn't come. And then the whole idea collapses.
That's a complex issue. But I think discussions like this shine some light on little things that people can do. As Jeff said, you guys can go out and find a park that you trust. Maybe donate $100 if you have it. You donate $1,000 if you have it.
Test them out. Make sure they're doing a good job first before you ramp it up. You know, we do that. It's called drip funding. You drip feed first, right? Make sure they do what they say they're going to do. Yeah. And then you build the trust, and then you do trust-based philanthropy. You know, you're not going to, you know, what the big problem is, you end up with these things where everyone's writing 400 pages of reports and not doing the actual patrolling and the work, right? That's not what you need. You right. need to make sure they're doing the patrolling on the ground, putting in the miles. You know, most of our parks, they're going from 0 to 20,000 kilometers a year. So once we get things rolling, they're going from almost zero, right, to patrolling the whole park. You got total coverage. That's what our goal is: arresting, prosecution, and total coverage, so the park is protected.
And this, and in turn, you have a safe place for wildlife and a safe place for tourists, and hopefully jobs for rangers and poachers that want to, you know, walk the straight line.
Guide associations and parks, you know, some of these parks have 300 to 400 certified guides, and those are good jobs. You take a group out for 4 nights, you know, you're getting paid $500. That's like 2 months of income for 5 nights.
Yeah, that's really good in a global perspective of things. So Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. If you wouldn't mind, please send us a list of parks that you really like, that you like to work with, and maybe we can relay it to our listeners if they feel the need to kick in.
Sure. Well, just go to our website, globalconservation.org. We got a map and we got a good list of all the projects. You know, from the closest project to the United States is Mirador National Park in northern Guatemala. And that's, if you read about that, that's probably one of the most fascinating places in the world, because you've got the intact forest, and you've got thousands of pyramids, temples, highways that they had. The Mayan built these highways for 50 miles, perfectly flat, you know, looked like a superhighway. They didn't even have the wheel at that time. So they were just walking on them, moving, you know, crops and slaves and whatever they were doing back and forth between these cities. But inside Mirador, there's like 18 cities as big as Tikal inside the jungle. So that's a 4-hour flight from California, very worthwhile park. But, you know, look on our website, a lot of other great parks we're working.
I think that's the Mirador Basin Project, right?
Mirador National Park, yeah. Mirador Dr. Richard Hansen does the Mirador Basin archaeological work.
I gotcha.
We're doing the park protection side.
I'm glad you mentioned it because one of our early episodes actually goes to Mirador with Discovery Channel host Josh Gates. So Josh comes on, he talks about his work down there and what they saw. Actually be great to do an ecology focused episode though, because that was all about temples and things, and I want to know what's around them. So Jeff, man, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time today and your expertise. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, keep up the great work, man. I'm going to start listening.
Thank you.
The Get Lost Podcast is a production of Sold Outside Exploration Company. Follow us on Instagram to connect at Get Lost Podcast and visit the website getlostpod.com.